TSN 1290, CFRW Winnipeg.
We will be there. Come with us.
Your official home of the Winnipeg Jets. A division of Bell Media.
If you want to know the real deal about the three, we're going to take it with triple chop. We're going to bring you up to speed.
TSN 1290 presents the Illegal Curve Hockey Show with Drew Mandel, Richard Pollock, and Ezra Ginsberg.
Good afternoon, Winnipeg. Good afternoon, Manitoba. And for all those joining us live this afternoon on TSN1290.ca, good afternoon, universe, and welcome to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. I'm your host, Drew Mandel, joined in studio by my colleagues Richard Pollock and Ezra Ginsberg. Producer Tim gets us on and off the air like the expert that he is. And you'll hear from Michael Remus at various points throughout this broadcast. We have a jam-packed 3 hours in store for you. Coming up in about 30 minutes time, the former executive director of the NHLPA, Paul Kelly, is going to join us. We're going to talk, obviously, CBA negotiations with him. Really, nobody knows better what it's like to negotiate against Gary Bettman and to be involved in, you know, CBA negotiations altogether, albeit at a time when there was an existing CBA. Paul Kelly is going to join us. A little bit later on, about 1:30 this afternoon, Michael McCann is going to join us. He is a lawyer. He's a law professor at the University of Vermont. He's also a he writes a law article for SportsIllustrated.com. We're going to talk to him about decertification and what that would mean for the NHLPA. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve. Follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/Illegal Curve. And our website for the latest NHL and Winnipeg Jets news is www.illegalcurve.com. Richie, Ezra, good afternoon, gentlemen. How are you doing?
Doing pretty well. Good afternoon, Drew. It's nice to be back in the studio after doing the show at U of M. It was lots of fun. Thanks to, obviously, the station and U of M for their hospitality. It was a great event.
What, we had the draft right now?
I know. I was
with,
just...
with Ezra's first overall selection, yeah. He is going to take the cherry Timbit.
Absolutely. No, but doing good. And obviously, we have, you know, more lockout news to talk about, try to break down decertification for everybody. Richie actually tried to decertify me from the Legal Curve hockey team, so unsuccessfully, though. Dave Manuk represented me, so
Oh, God.
We have two lawyers on the team, so.
Yeah, well, we're all in a lot of trouble in that case. Richie, good afternoon. How you doing, bud?
Drew, I've been better.
You're a little under the... I probably should interrupt and say, you know, Illegal Curve is playing hurt this week.
Yeah, Illegal Curve's playing hurt.
Richie's under the weather. He's got the, you know, a cold and flu bug. Ezzy, meanwhile, is in extreme discomfort as he has a herniated disc.
I'm telling you right now, this is the most pain I've ever been in. And I've torn my ECL and MCL before. And
On a positive note, you're already doing more rehab for your herniated disc than you ever did for your ACL and MCL tear.
Right. The ACL MCL tear was about 5 years ago, and I just drank, and it slowly and slowly just got worse and worse and worse. Yeah, but we're a little bit banged up, but, you know, we're here. We're always going to be here.
Yeah, I'm feeling quite well myself. So, you know, if anybody was concerned about me, but
well, you're an athlete. I mean, you eat properly, you exercise. I've never seen someone plank for 10 minutes before.
mid traffic.
Mid traffic. Yeah, that's the way I roll. Let's start with the cancellation, obviously, yesterday of some additional hockey games through the 14th of December. So if there is going to be an NHL season come December 15th, that'll be Penguins at Jets. But I think we're a long way off from that happening, of course.
So the rumor is, Drew, that if there is a shortened season at this point, it'll be completely intra-conference.
Which is what it was in 94. Within the 48-game season, it was just an inter-conference schedule at that point in time. So we lost another 96 more regular season games yesterday. No surprise, really, to anybody at that point in time. In addition, we also lost the All-Star game. I'd be fine if we permanently lost the All-Star game because I find it to be a complete and total waste of time. But here we are, another 96 games lost. You know, I suppose there was some feeling of optimism earlier in the week, but now it's gone by the wayside, I'd say.
The optimism, the problem is that the publicity regarding this is, you know, the PA will hype up an offer and then they'll have an offer coming, and then the NHL will have probably telegraph their reply. So I think Well, I think one thing that this lockout has demonstrated, at least to me, is that the insiders don't know much at all. If anything. Nobody's really been right about anything yet. Nobody's to make predictions. I mean, this is any network. Nobody really knows what the heck's going on. And a lot of sources have been lost, I think, throughout this process. Elliot Friedman's talked about that. People pick sides, and then so what happens is the insiders of the NHL don't know anything about the PA. And the PA guys don't know anything about the NHL.
And to that point, one of the complaints, or not one of the complaints necessarily, but one of the comments that we've heard multiple times throughout this entire process is how frustrating or how frustrated the NHL is with Donald Fehr in that they really can't read him.
Right.
They don't understand, know thy enemy. Mm-hmm. One of the, the first rules of warfare, right? Sun Tzu. One of his
read
rules.
That book through The Art of War.
Yeah, exactly.
When did you go to China?
I haven't ever been there, but it's true. I have been to many Chinese food restaurants, and they're just confounded by the negotiating tactics that Donald Fehr has taken throughout this entire process.
That's funny. It's funny you mentioned that, though. I mean, everyone knows about Donald Fehr and his nearly two decades at the helm of the Major League Baseball Players Association, and they know what he did there and how he was able to, basically change the economics for the players for the betterment of the players, but. He's been the head of the NHLPA for about 2 years now, and they know about his past history. But this is, this is a little bit different here. He's coming into a situation where the NHLPA was completely, for lack of a better term, was completely almost dismantled after the last lockout, and you had the Ted Saskin and coming in after Goodenow.
Well, they kept eating their own. I mean, Paul Kelly was a guy who, and we're going to hear from him in about 25 minutes' time. Paul Kelly came in there with all the credentials in the world that you would want from a guy to lead your PA, but he got eaten alive by warring factions within the NHL, led primarily by Eric Lindros.
Yeah. But, Drew, getting back to what Richie said about,
he's been successful.
About the insiders, though, and, them not knowing anything, and I think you can look at the frustration of the players and what they're saying, whether it's Roman Hamrlich or Ray Whitney had some comments this week. It doesn't matter, how you look at it. I think the insiders and the media generally don't know that much because we don't really know how this is unfolding. There's this whole decertification threat has popped up as maybe, an option. And I know we're going to talk about that after, but I really think right now it's a coin flip. It's 50-50 whether we're going to have a season or not. Some people gave up a month ago and said, they're just too far apart. And the NHLPA obviously came out with the proposal.
The irony of your comment right there that they're too far apart is, first of all, getting ahead of myself a bit. Everybody says this $182 million is the gap. I mean, they say it as if it's gospel.
No.
But that's the number from the PA. Just because the PA says doesn't mean it's true. Just like when the NHL says, we're $1 billion apart just because they say it, it's not true. That's the number is somewhere between those two. So, don't parrot the $182 million line because that's just a Donald Fehr line. But, neither side has shown any interest, really, in getting a deal done.
I think that's
the most aggravating part to people.
And that's the reality. It's not that one side doesn't want to get a deal done. The NHLPA is saying that you've heard ad nauseum that, this is the best offer they can present, which everyone knows in negotiation, specifically that's the best offer, the best deal, or the best offer is the one that results in a deal. And hopefully what they were hoping was this would at least, at the very least, provide a framework to get a deal done. And you're right. Donald Fehr very, very much so intentionally put out that $182 million number to show that the NHLPA has come further. That was very intentional and very smart, I believe, on his part. But as far as really what that means with all of this make-whole money and what it means over the course of a CBA, because you got to remember, the NHL's original proposal, Richie, was for a 7-year CBA.
Well, I mean, we're going to go through this.
We're sort of just giving the high-level discussion right now. Starting next segment and for a number of segments throughout this show, we're going to go through the NHLPA's offer in very minute detail, just like we did with the NHL's three offers. I guess that would almost have been a month ago now or so.
Yeah, I mean, you guys have negotiated for more than, I think, a few days total.
Well, yesterday was the most aggravating day to me. Both sides went around and did the radio rounds, and they did, you know, you heard Bill Daly here on 1290, and, you know, Steve Fear was doing the radio rounds.
I could write the answers before the interview. Oh,
of course. You can, I mean, you know the questions and you know the answers.
We want to be met. We want to have a willing partner. We want to negotiate. Right now, we've reached our limit of how far we can go. We just need a partner, and then the other side is, well, we need a deal. And it's just...
Why do they even bother?
It's like watching the presidential debates, because you know what's going to be said already.
Talking points.
And you mentioned before many times, Drew, on this show in the past number of months, while we've been dealing with the lockout, is stop talking to the fans like we're idiots.
I'll give Gary Bettman credit. I thought when that fan jumped out of him, I guess Wednesday afternoon, I thought he handled that well.
I did too.
He did.
Don't underestimate Gary Bettman, you know, I think speaking in this room, we certainly don't. But this guy has been the head of the NHL for so many years, and it's not because he's a stupid guy.
No, first of all, we know Gary Bettman's smart. We're not saying he's a bad guy. I mean, if they lose a season, he has to be fired because you can't lose two of your last nine seasons. That's absurd.
If the owners deem this a win, he won't be fired.
No, of course not.
He's under contract for, I believe, three more years anyways.
It's like David Stern.
Those contracts can be removed.
It's like David Stern. I mean, he decides when he wants to leave.
That's right. He's got a lifetime contract, and he'll be there till he doesn't want to be there anymore.
But, I mean, you know, has Bettman managed this lockout well so far? No, I don't think so. Has Ferrer managed it well? I mean, I don't think so either. I mean, to me, we talked about it a couple of weeks ago, the November 30th was the drop dead date, you know, the fourth paycheck, as I calculated it, would it be the point where after that date, which is, let's say, the 24th.
It's so coming up next week.
Yeah. 6 days away, after that day, the players would have made more money over the course of the contract at a 5% rate of growth.
If they had taken
the NHL's offer.
If they had accepted the reduction on November 30th, the players would have been, you know, quote unquote, made whole. Yeah. No.
Well, you know, Richie mentions, you know,
it would have been
Bettman managing, you know, the lockout. And the reality is, I know it's frustrating for the fans. In fact, it's downright aggravating.
Easier to say.
But, you know,
He's got a lot of T3s going through his bloodstream
exactly.
right now.
He's
wearing
cats. Gary Bettman works for the owners, and if the owners want this lockout to end, trust me, it'll end. He's not going to stand as holier than thou. And same goes for Fear. Fear works with the players. If a big enough majority of them said, you know what, that's a good enough deal. Let's get this done.
Sure.
And to be honest with you, the division, and there was divisions last time, and I don't want to hear that, you know, there's starting to be divisions. Roman Hamrlik is an isolated incident where he spoke out, and trust me, players around the league were not happy with what he said. He's more than in his own right to say that.
He's also 100% correct for Roman Hamrlik, who's definitely on his last contract. He will not get another contract.
He's done.
If there's no season, his NHL career is finished. And he knows it.
What's mind-boggling, Drew, is that I think he's missed 160, 200 games with all the lockouts throughout his career. There have been exactly that much money lost and that much of his career lost. Timo Salani's another guy that's gone through all of them.
Jerome Iginla.
Yeah.
Jerome Iginla hasn't gone through all of them, but yeah, you're right, as he's going through all of them.
I think there's about 12 players.
Oh, these are the guys who need to, in their own best interest, if they're putting themselves ahead of the union. And we'll talk in more detail about the whole back and forth between Hamrlik and Eric Cole and Troy Brouwer and Michael Neuwirth. If they, are looking out for themselves and themselves only, they absolutely need to be screaming from the rooftops.
You can be selfish. I mean, that's your money.
Yeah. I'd be selfish in that instance as well. I mean, it doesn't, and it wouldn't really leave me with a second thought. Before the lockout started, I would have been screaming from the rooftops about how ridiculous this is.
Yeah.
But, you know. Right now, those guys, for the most part, are staying quiet, at least publicly. We'll see how much longer that lasts. Just like we'll see how much longer it lasts. You know, I can see James Dolan coming out, and Ed Snyder tried to deny it after the fact, but James Dolan needs the programming for his television network.
Yeah, but James Dolan has gone at Gary Bettman before and has lost. I don't think he's going to do it again.
Well, that's fine, but there are people who...
What about the fact that Molson's and the Bell Rogers partnership has been hardly involved, according to reports?
Well, probably because they're new owners and they're trying to keep their powder dry.
The truth is, there's only apparently the owners in the last meeting were Murdy Edwards.
Yeah, in Calgary, who's a hardliner.
Yeah, Jeremy Jacobs.
Yeah.
Craig Leopold.
Yeah.
And now I'm forgetting the last person in that meeting. But
it would have been Ed Snyder.
No, it wasn't Snyder. No, he's over in
Paris or wherever.
I think, I don't know if, we'll look into it, but Ted Leonsis has been there too.
Yeah, Leonsis was the other one. Thanks, Ezzy. So there's four owners.
Yeah.
And apparently Jeremy Jacobs does all the talking.
Yeah. He's the hardest of all the
hardliners. I'm of the opinion, we're going to be asking our guests later about this, but I'm of the opinion that there's too many people in the room. And the room has just far too many egos and personalities. You need to cut it down to a few people on both sides, 3-4, and get some negotiations started. Because you can't have players coming into random meetings. I don't care if they've been kept abreast of the situation. You can't have a player come in the random meetings and then, you know, like Ron Hainsey, he's been in a lot of meetings, but getting in arguments and stuff and bickering.
Well, Elliot Friedman in his column this week outlines a story, and I mean, it sounds like it's been pretty accurate.
I've heard about it. I've had people too. Yeah.
That Hainsey and Gary Bettman got into a screaming match.
Yeah.
It's not generally good for Ron Hainsey's future NHL prospect.
There's rumors that Ron Hainsey wants to get involved with the PA after his career. Ron Hainsey is an interesting case. His cap this year is $4.5 million. His salary is $3 million. And any smart general manager won't give him anything close to that in his next contract. So he likely will never make the money he's going to be making this year. The fact that he got his last contract from Don Waddell was a joke in itself, frankly.
Yeah.
And so it's interesting to see that, you know, it's an unselfish point of view in terms of he's fighting, knowing he's going to lose money. But also, I mean, the system... In a sense, to me, I said this before, the system, it benefits average players like Ron Hainsey.
Right.
Because the top players are underpaid as far as I'm concerned, and the bottom middle players are overpaid. And so, I mean, how much does he want to change the system?
Probably not that much.
I don't know.
It's interesting. Let's go to break. When we come back, we're going to start going into the NHLPA's offer to the NHL. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290. Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Coming up in about 10 minutes' time, former executive director of the NHLPA, Paul Kelly, is going to join us. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve. Follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/Illegal Curve. And the website with all your latest NHL and Winnipeg Jets news is www.illegalcurve.com. This segment of the program is brought to you by Carbone Coal-Fired Pizza, home of Canada's only coal-fired pizza oven. Taste the difference at Carbone Coal-Fired Pizza, 1580 Taylor Avenue, pizza baked, well done. We're going to be at Carbone, I believe it's next Saturday, right?
Yes.
Yeah, we have a function.
That's right.
I believe it's what it's called. I'm looking forward to that.
I have a date, hot date.
Dinner with friends?
Dinner alone.
Ogging the girls.
That one never gets old, by the way.
And you're not a big Simpsons fan.
No, I'm never a huge Simpsons fan. I'm never a big cartoon fan.
Yeah, but that was just a good line.
It's a good line.
Series of
lines. I got into Family Guy later on, too.
Let's start talking on the... Let's start with the NHL's negotiation.
Sure.
Pardon me, the NHL's offer to the NHL. The NHLPA's offer to the NHL. Well, I'll try that again.
Yeah, come on.
Sorry. Let's start here. You know, first of all, the concept...
I have to say before you start, Drew, because I read over the offer a number of times, the offer is very, lacks description in many portions. So when we try and interpret what it exactly means, there's a lot of assumptions within it that would, you know, again, they would assume that we know what they're referring to, and that's, you know, I don't know what they're referring to. So there's portions here where we're going to be interpreting, and we're unsure whether or not that's true or not.
Right. So let's start with the player share, because that's really been the sticking point. And the NHL, you know, the NHL wants the 50-50. The NHLPA claims that they're down to 50-50, but they're not. I mean, they are... You know, they're at 50-50 in terms of revenue, but that doesn't include the make whole. When you include the make whole, the numbers really break down to 56% for this coming year, 54% for the next year, 52%, and then by 2015-2016, they're down to 50-50.
Right.
It seems as though both sides have agreed that there is going to be a make whole element, and that's going to be borne by the owners, at least. So, you know, if it's not 50-50 immediately, is 56 in the first year enough to get something done here? Or do you think that's NHLPA is still quite there?
The NHLPA is going to sell it, Drew, is that it's 50-50 throughout. That's how they sell it.
Right.
To the public.
Yeah. And but, I mean, you can go out and say anything, but the facts don't back it up.
Now, how they do it now, you know, they're apart by $182 million is how they say it, right?
Right.
So, the NHLPA makes some assumptions in their figures, such that, you know, the league revenue is going to be down this year, which is probably a pretty good assumption. Well, it's going to be down.
And that's an issue, and we spoke about it last week briefly, is if there is a this year, How do they divide that pie? Because that's still very much up in the air, and the NHLPA seems to think that they're entitled to a much larger percentage of it than they are.
Right.
Or than the NHL would say they are. But, I mean, if you look at it, you know, the NHLPA's proposed make-whole over the course of the next 5 years is $393 million, the bulk of that coming in the first 2 years.
So they call these transition payments is what they call them.
That's right. It's to guarantee all the players the contracts and to bring down the numbers.
In the first year, the transition payments, as the NHLPA describes them, are $149 million and $33 million combined.
So totaling $182 million.
That's the first year.
Mm-hmm.
The second year, they call the transition payment one is $62 million. Transition payment two is $66
million. Totaling $128 million. So in addition to the 50-50 split, the NHL would pay out in the first year $182 million, and in the second year, $128 million.
So just to give you specifications on that, the first year, 2012-13, based on $182 million and a 50-50 split, would be 56.1%, as you mentioned. The second year would be 53.8% of overall revenue. The third year, there's no transition payment one. There's only a transition payment two,
right,
and it's $72 million,
right,
totaling a percentage of 52%.
Right. So the players are right now, 3 years into a proposed new CBA,
right,
the players are still getting 52% of hockey-related revenue.
Exactly. And so in the fourth year, final year, this is a final payment. There's no transition payment one. There's only the second. A transition payment two is for a small total of $11 million, taking the percentage to 50.3%.
Right.
And the final year, there's no transition payments, and the percentage is a flat 50-50. It's based upon a 5-year proposal, meaning that basically in that final year is when you get to the 50-50 split to set up your next negotiation.
That's exactly right. So the NHL, when you take the 5 years and all the transition payments, as we're calling them, when you take the NHLPA says that they are entitled to transition payments of $393 million.
Yeah.
The owners say they are entitled to transition payments of $211 million.
So let's
leaving
get into that.
A gap of $182 million.
Let's get into the difference. So that's over the course of 5 years.
Right.
So the first year, the difference is $33 million.
Mm-hmm.
$33 million bucks. So basically $1 million in bucks a team.
That's right.
Second year, it's $66 million. So it's about $2 million bucks a team.
Mm-hmm.
And the third year, it's $72 million. So, you know, two and a bit.
Yeah, a little more.
And the last year, it's $11 million. So it's basically nothing for these teams.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what it is. I mean, 182 over the course of 5 years, that's based on a projection of, you know, a 10% drop in revenue in the first year, meaning all the lockout year.
10% to me, at this point, even seems a little bit on the low side.
It does. I'm assuming it was produced strictly for a season to start December 1, probably.
Right.
60-some game season. They project in the following year that the percentage is raised to 13.9%. That's what Donald Fair is presenting. 13.9%, you have to take that into account, the fact that it's 10% down and then 13.9% up.
So it's really, it's 13% higher from, say, last year.
Yeah, so I mean, like, you're looking at taking the loss into account, really about a 4% increase. And then the following years, he has about 5% each year. Now remember, the NHL has been growing at about a 7% clip. I'm not so sure that continues. Obviously, the Canadian TV deal and the addition of the U.S. TV deal will help, but, you know, it seems like some of the marketing avenues have probably been exhausted at this point, so it's interesting to see how much further this game goes in terms of revenue growth.
After the Canadian TV deal, I would think that would sort of be the peak for a little while, and then it might just plateau.
Depends on the regional TV deals, when they're up and all that stuff, right? And that's where the money is now.
Right, because, I mean, as you saw in baseball, the regional TV deals, like the Los Angeles Dodgers, is a billion-dollar regional deal, never mind national deal.
That's right.
If what this NHL lockout is all about now is it, not all about, but a big portion of it is the make whole, and I realize that there are more complexities to this, but if the NHL was offering $211 million, and I think you guys know where I'm going with this, if the NHL offered $211 million in make whole payments, transition payments, as they like to call it, they're honoring players' contracts to transition from the lower portion of revenue. If they offer $211 and then the NHLPA's offer included $393 and there's $182 million difference, why can't they meet in the middle?
Yep. It's a reasonable
question. It seems pretty simple at this point. If it's $180 million, Drew, call it 50%, or let's get closer to 50% of that. That's where I'm confused as to why the NHLPA's offer hasn't provided a better framework for coming to an eventual deal.
It's a fair point. As you look at 182, you start off in the middle. You say it's 91.
Yeah.
Okay?
91.
You say 91.
It's $3
million. $3 million per team over the course of a five. Now, they have to extend it more than 5 years. We'll talk about that in a second. But $3 million over 5 years for these million and billionaire teams. I mean, come on.
It's the cost of it. It's the cost of nothing.
Cost of nothing.
When you look at it that way, and I'm beginning to think, I mean, they seem to be pretty close on the make-whole argument.
Yeah.
I think some of those secondary issues, some of the other things in this PA offer, yeah, I think are really going to be the sticking point. Namely, and we won't have time to get into it right away because we have Paul Kelly coming up, yeah, in a couple minutes. But the one that jumps out to me as being the real real problematic one is the fact that the NHLPA is insisting that the salary cap will never
not
drop less than $67.25 million.
The non-starter is that the salary won't go down from, will never go down after the second year of the contract of the CBA, which is completely absurd. Well, all that means, it's simple. That means the NHL incurs all of the risk and the NHLPA incurs no risk. That's a non-starter, and I don't see the owners agreeing to that under any circumstances.
Because what's that?
If you want to be partners, sorry to interrupt, yeah, sure, but if you want to be partners, I mean, I think the partners is bull on both sides, but if you want to pretend to be partners,
then you have to be partners, right, all the way through, not, right, just for a year. That $67.25 million is what their NHLPA is trying to do at that point with that number,
yep,
is to remove the salary cap from being tied to revenues. They're establishing, yeah, a minimum. Right. Yeah. They're establishing a floor.
I mean, I personally don't think it's going to be an issue. I think the revenues will increase enough that it's not going to be. But
I suspect so, but can't guarantee that.
If something tanks, the Canadian dollar tanks.
Can't guarantee, right, that.
Something other stuff tanks. Who knows what happens? You cannot leave it being the sole responsibility of the owners.
Exactly right. If the Canadian dollar tanks again and goes down to 65 cents,
yeah, right,
all of a sudden the markets that are generating the bulk of your revenue are doing so with a huge handicap,
right. Right.
And your revenue projections are going to fall just the same. We're going to get into that in more detail. Let's go to break. When we come back, former executive director of the NHLPA, Paul Kelly, is going to join us. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show live on TSN 1290. Yeah. Shortly past 12:30 in the afternoon, welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve. Follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/Illegal Curve. And our website for the latest NHL and Winnipeg Jets news is www.illegalcurve.com.
Now, let's go live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show hotline.
Let's welcome to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. He's the former executive director of the NHLPA, and he's a partner at Jackson Lewis LLP Law Firm in Boston. Paul Kelly, thanks very much for joining us. Happy Thanksgiving, and welcome to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
Thanks very much. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, pleased that you're able to join us on this Saturday afternoon. Paul, you know, obviously being a hockey show, all we've been able to talk about for the last number of months has been the CBA and the CBA negotiations. Let's start with this question. You know, are you surprised that history might be repeating itself?
Well, both surprised and disappointed, frankly. We're the last time around in 2004-05, you know, the parties were talking about a complete system change. It didn't surprise a lot of us that, you know, you lost the entire season. But here, you're not talking about that type of a radical change. You're really only talking about, you know, the division of the, you know, vast revenues as well as some contract issues. And you would have thought or hoped that the parties would have been able to work it out and recognize the damage that losing, number one, what you've already lost, which is almost half a season, and the prospect of losing an entire season. So, yes, I'm surprised.
Paul, as an outsider, but also someone who is the former executive director of the NHLPA, what would you have done differently in this process up to this date?
Well, you know, it's a little bit of a dangerous question, and I don't want to be critical of either side here, and because everybody has their own style, and it would be hard to question either Don Fehr or Gary Bettman, because they both obviously have long experience and you know, extensive backgrounds in labor law, but I think a couple of things I would have done differently. Number one, I certainly would have started the discussions a lot earlier, probably way back in at least January or February of last season. I would have done them very quietly. I would have tried to do it off the radar. You know, once you, of course, again, the executive director works for the players and really just is there to carry out the desires of the majority of the players, and so you would need to have taken time to educate the players and then get a consensus view of what the players wanted to do. But I would have tried to start the discussions earlier, and I think the second thing I would have done is avoided the kind of media volley that we've seen. I think that the dueling press conferences and, you know, casting aspersions on either side or the positions that the other side has taken, I don't think it's helpful to the process. I think that trying to keep those discussions, you know, more private would have been a prudent thing to do, because what you've seen develop here is a pretty poisonous relationship. And as the tensions rise and as players start, you know, sending imprudent emails and tweets about the other side out over the public airwaves, that just makes it more difficult for them to come to terms. You know, so those are a couple of ways I would have approached it differently.
Paul, do you think there's too many people in the negotiating room right now?
Yeah, I don't know how many people are actually in the main room, but you're probably pretty right about that. I mean, in addition to having the two principals from either side, you probably have in-house lawyers, and then you've got outside lawyers, and of course, you've got PR people. You know, and then of course you've got players. I mean, I'm frankly very much in support of having players participate actively in the meetings and opening it up to any player who wants to attend. But it does make it more difficult, frankly, and it does change the dimension of the discussion when you have certain people in the room. I mean, I'm not sure you can say some of the things that you might want to say, or that you say them in the same way. Mm-hmm. If you have an audience of players and PR people, than you would if it was just a small group of 4 to 6 people. I know they've tried both approaches. I know they've had large groups, and I think they've also tried smaller groups. But I would favor a smaller contingent of people.
We're joined on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show by Paul Kelly, the former executive director of the NHLPA. Paul, obviously not very many people have the experience in negotiating against or, you know, with Gary Bettman, as the case may be. You know, how would you describe his negotiation style?
Well, I mean, he's a smart guy, really very smart guy, and he picks up on issues. He's also been at this for 20 years. I mean, he's got the strong support of his ownership group. He has a constitutional setup which doesn't require him to have the full backing of all 30 owners. He's got the very strong backing of his 8-person executive committee and probably solid backing from at least 2/3 of the team. So he goes into it with a confidence level. He also has leverage, frankly. He has more leverage than does Don Fehr. It's easier for the management side of the game, for the owners, to withstand a lockout than it is for players, and I think he recognizes all of those things. But I do think, and I'm, you know, I do follow, you know, some of the media that's been going on out there, and I know that Mr. Bettman has been vilified in the press and by the fans, particularly north of the border, and some of that is warranted. But those who don't believe that he's a supporter of the game, or doesn't care about the development of the game, and doesn't want to see the game back on the ice, well, they really don't know Gary. And having dealt with him, I don't believe any of that for a minute. I really do think he wants to see this thing solved, but he does have his marching orders, as does Don Fehr from his ownership side, and he's clearly not going to bend on some of those key issues.
Paul, over the past 10 weeks, we've obviously heard a lot about Gary Bettman, and we've heard a lot about Donald Fehr, but what about Bill Daly and Steve Fehr, and how big of a role do those two play?
I think bigger as time goes along. Don and Gary, they're kind of the face of their respective sides. I'm not sure a whole lot gets done when the two of them get in the room. If you remember the 0405 lockout, it was really resolved by Bill Daly and at the time Ted Sask, and it wasn't Bob Goodenow and Gary Bettman. And I think, frankly, if you're going to solve this one, probably it's going to come down to Bill Daly and Steve Fehr. I mean, Bill Daly, I know Bill better than I know Steve, but Bill is a really smart guy, a little bit more of a kind of a people person than Gary Bettman is. He's an affable, well-liked person both by not only by the owners, but by the media and really by the players who get to know Bill. You know, he's smart, but he's also reasonable. I mean, you know, Bill, I think, recognizes when he has to give a little bit here and there. And so I think having him kind of take the lead would not be such a bad thing. Steve here, I've had dealings with in the past, seems like a reasonable guy, a little bit more low-key than his brother. Not the kind of, you know, hard charger that you see when, you know, Don's standing behind a podium and giving one of his press conferences, which comes across to a lot of people like a lecture. It's just kind of a style thing. So I think both Steve and Bill, you know, could well be the key players as this thing moves along.
Paul, you know, in your experience, obviously, dealing with the players, from an outsider's point of view, we can't sometimes get a read on how many players are really actively involved in the process. I mean, I guess it's hard for you to maybe put a number on it. Maybe a percentage would be easier. But how many players are actively engaged on a, maybe not a day-to-day basis, but maybe a week-to-week basis in the process and how the Players Association is functioning?
You know, I think clearly your negotiating committee is actively involved. If they're not on every call, they're on most every call, and they're certainly being filled in. So that's roughly 30 of your membership. And then you've had a number of additional players and some high-profile players. You know, Sidney's been involved in, you know, at least two or three of the meetings that I know of. You know, recently you saw Vinny LeCavalier, Marty St. Louis, you know, appear in the meetings in New York. So, I mean, again, nearly half your membership, you know, has gone overseas to play in Russia and over in Europe. And so of the guys that are back here, you know, there may be as many as, you know, 50 to 75 that are really paying close attention and, you know, talking, participating in conference calls and the like. And that's a good thing. I mean, if you remember 04 or 05, it was a fairly small negotiating committee.
Right.
Actually boiled down to about five players, you know, Billy Guerin and, you know, Trevor Linden and those guys. And then, of course, you know, when the players were dissatisfied with the end result, you know, those guys took an awful lot of heat, much of which was unjustified, because it was a thankless task that they were involved in there in trying to bring an end to that last lockout. But so I think that Don, one of the things Don's done well here is not only educate the players, but get them all involved and make sure that the positions that he's taking, you know, really do reflect the consensus of his membership.
You're listening to TSN 1290 and the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're joined by Paul Kelly. He's the former executive director of the NHLPA. Paul, the buzzword this weekend, in addition to turkey and tryptophan and stuffing, has been decertification. Would you recommend that the NHLPA decertify as a union?
That's a major step, really a major step. you know, if you were going to decertify, you probably should have taken that step some time ago. I think to have waited this far along and then to talk about decertification as an option, I'm not sure it makes a great deal of sense, but you would clearly lose the entire remainder of the season, if not most of all of next season, if you put this into the courts, because what you're talking about is disbanding the union, at least in theory, and then filing lawsuits in various places, seeking protection under the antitrust laws of the United States and Canada. It's far more complex in the hockey setting because, you know, you do have franchises in both countries and citizens of both countries. And, you know, unlike the NFL, you know, where all of your franchises are based in the U.S., you really have a much more convoluted set of circumstances, you know. It's a high-risk, high-stakes game. I mean, if you're the players and you decertify and you file this lawsuit, which takes a couple of years, and then at the end of the day, a court rules against you that you don't have, you haven't, you know, established the antitrust monopolistic practices. Now what have you gained? I mean, you've thrown the sport into complete, you know, chaos. So, if you're going to take that step, you really have to have determined that you have reached the end of the road, that there's just no other place for you to go, that you absolutely, under no circumstances, can negotiate any further and gain any additional concessions, and you can't accept what they put on the table. If that's the conclusion that you reach, then, you know, that's one of the few options that you have left. But it's a really serious step, and I would hope we don't get there.
Well, you know, looking at it from a cost-benefit analysis, and obviously pride's on the line for both parties, and that's a factor in any negotiation, but if you look at it as the players maybe would be getting their fourth paycheck on November 30th, and if you take just based on the math, you know, $3.3 billion last year, and you cut it into each paycheck, it's possible that after waiting, you know, waiting past November will cost the players more money than if they'd accepted an offer, say, three, four weeks ago from the NHL. How much do the numbers play into it in terms of overall dollar value in an offer as compared to maybe some issues within the actual collective bargaining agreement that they're probably not that comfortable with?
Yeah, I don't know at this point that it's really the dollars. First of all, the two sides don't agree on what the dollars. I mean, you keep hearing all week, you know, Don Fehr saying, you know, we're only $182 million apart. I don't believe that the owners agree with that sentiment, but I don't think it's the numbers. I mean, I think that it's some of the contract issues and it's some of the clauses and requirements that the Players Association included in its proposal on Wednesday, you know, including the one that said that, you know, under no circumstances, you know, in years 2 through 5, you know, may the, you know, amount, the percentage that goes to the players, you know, be any less than it was, you know, in year 2. Mm-hmm. And then some other language in there that made it clear that, you know, their proposal envisioned them only sharing in the upside with no sharing in the risk. So if there was a downturn in the American or the Canadian economy, or if the fans turned away in such a degree that, you know, the revenues dropped from, say, $3.5 billion down to $3 billion flat, I mean, what would happen is that 50-50 split would no longer be 50-50, the percentage of the revenue under that kind of a scheme. So the players would go substantially higher. And so from the owner's perspective, you know, they're not going to accept those types of clauses. It's not what they envision in the kind of 50-50 that they're proposing. So, I mean, one of the great frustrations that the players had in 0405 is that, you know, they lost an entire season, and then they ended up with a deal, frankly, that they could have had prior to the lost season. You know, and then halfway through that lost season, you know, they were told that, you know, they would accept the salary cap when not only prior to that season, but for 2 years prior to that lost season, you know, they kept hearing from the leadership, under no circumstances will we accept the cap. And, you know, there's a risk that the same thing could happen here. I mean, they may end up losing an entire season and then settling this thing in July, which is what happened after the 04-05 season, and end up with the exact same deal that was on the table today, and they will have lost their paychecks, which, of course, in most instances is in the millions of dollars, and the owners would have lost millions of dollars, and everybody will look back and say, what were we thinking? And, you know, that's why, you know, it's unfathomable to most of us that the parties don't realize what's at stake here and what they're losing and can't figure out some way to get together and make it work.
Paul, we've got one final question for you. And again, we appreciate you taking the time to come on A Legal Curve. You know, if you could pick one side, or, you know, your answer might be both sides, but, you know, to date, who do you think is more responsible for the CBA not getting done yet?
You know, I think it's a two-way street. There's no question about it. I mean, look, I'm a players guy, and from the players' perspective, you know, they gave back a lot in the 04-05, you know, lost season in the last CBA, and there was a big rollback, and they changed the entire system, and they, you know, imposed some restrictions on the contract. And, of course, coming out of that, the players really felt that they had been defeated. You know, time has shown that, in fact, that CBA worked better for players perhaps than it did for owners, and a lot better for players than they thought coming out of the deal. You know, average salaries increased tremendously. You know, but again, the players now say, okay, wait a minute now. You know, here you want us to give back again after trumpeting, you know, 5 years of incredible advances and revenue generation and what a great success, you know, playoffs have been and the Winter Classic has been, and everything is rosy. And now it's time to CBA negotiations, and you tell us, you know, it's doom and gloom, and, you know, three-quarters of the teams are doing okay, and a quarter are virtually bankrupt, and the players are going to have to, you know, step up and, you know, make major sacrifices. And so, you know, players have a difficult time with that whole approach and that whole story. And so, I mean, I think the NHL made a mistake coming out of the gates back in July with an offer that the players viewed as insulting, and it set a certain tone for these negotiations. But again, the players themselves, you know, I think the players want to play. I think you're starting to see some dissension in the ranks. You know, it's hard to keep 740 guys kind of all together on the same page. They've done a really masterful job of it to date. You lose another paycheck next week and then another one 2 weeks later, and again, it's going to be harder and harder to keep those players together in terms of this. So, you know, there's some responsibility that goes both ways here. I don't think you can point the finger at one side.
Paul Kelly, former executive director of the NHLPA, thank you very much for joining us this afternoon on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We'll let you get back to your Thanksgiving weekend and your family. Much appreciated for your time.
Thanks, guys.
Take care, Paul. Thanks very much. Let's go to break. That was terrific. Some great insight that we can talk about after these commercial messages. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show live on TSN 1290. 5 minutes before the top of the hour, welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve. Follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/IllegalCurve. And our website is www.illegalcurve.com. Tremendous interview with Paul Kelly. In case you missed any of that interview, we will get it up just as quickly as possible, both on IllegalCurve.com and on TSN.ca or TSN1290.ca. So you'll be able to hear that. You can also download the show on iTunes. That'll be up a little bit later on this weekend. Listening to that interview, Hard not to believe that this would be a much different negotiation. Yep. If Paul Kelly was involved and not Donald Fehr.
I think what you do, Drew, and I think it's something that we've spoken about in the show over the past number of weeks, and it's a matter of reasonability.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a new course of negotiating. It's a course of negotiating that's kind of taken over in this day and age, and not the old way. And I think what you have here is Gary Bettman and Donald Fehr engaged in the old way. I have a hard time believing that Paul Kelly, and whether it had been Gary Bettman or Bill Daly, couldn't have reached a reasonable resolution in a quicker time period.
A couple of the most interesting things that, you know, Paul Kelly said, and he's not the first person to say this, and I think we'd all probably agree with this, is that in 2004, 2005, the players could have had the same offer, you know, at the beginning, and they could have avoided the lockout. And the fact that the players actually came out better after the 2004-2005 lockout because the salary cap was tied to revenues. And, you know, and then Paul Kelly went on to talk about how, you know, the NHL set a bad tone with a deal that the NHLPA, you know, found, you know, offensive. And really, you have to think that, you know, some of the things that have gone on during these negotiations over the last 10 weeks or so have been pretty irrational. And, you know, when you break it down to the NHLPA's most recent offer, and, you know, basically when you get down to, you know, nickel and diming, you know, even though it's $182 million, really, you have to think, why didn't they just, you know, come out with this months ago? Why did it take this long to get to this point?
And these are the questions that we've asked and we've
asked.
There's
no answer.
And there's no rational answer.
Yeah.
It really just does seem to come down to ego and legacy.
I agree with a number of things, but especially that when Donald Fehr and Gary Bettman are in the room together, not much gets done.
Yeah.
And also to his point about people, too many people in the room, and specifically to his point about how you can't necessarily be as open with what you're saying. And I completely agree with that, because it's like anything in life. Are you more apt to be a little bit more honest and maybe say some things that are off the record with three people in the room or 15?
There's no reason. I mean, how often? I mean, in the course of life, is something productive taking place when you have 15,
That's
20
right.
people in a room? You hear
exactly
a lot
right.
of chatter and a lot of noise, but down to the nuts and bolts of it and the brass tacks of it all, you never really get anything done until a couple people sit around in a small group, and you know what? And the size of that group is usually maximum four people.
Usually.
And that's it. You know, four is the number. Four is the perfect number for a dinner party. Four is the perfect number for a negotiation.
I don't know who said that.
Who said that about the dinner party?
I was with you until you said
is that even a party?
It's an old Bill Simmons thing where he says that four is the right number for, you know.
That's just a dinner. That's not a party.
Well, yeah, exactly. Dinner, it's not a party.
You need like minimum eight or ten for it to be a dinner party.
Fine. Okay.
But we were with you up until then. But you know, another thing, Drew, is, you know, on that point, The union is more unified than 2004, 2005. I think we can all agree on that.
Yeah, they are right now.
They are right now. And Donald Fear, you know, has been good. But let me get in there.
You say unified, but I love to know what they were like. I don't remember, but what they were like in November of 2004. Maybe they were that unified right now. I don't remember. No, sorry, keep going.
Yeah, no, I mean, the point, I was just going to make a quick point because I know this is going to be a quick segment, but, you know, I don't know how good, I don't know how beneficial it is for Donald Fear to have Ron Hainsey and Sidney Crosby and Kevin Westgarth and Le Cavalier and the players go on and on and on, 20 players, and then you have to inform them and you have to have them as kind of like your posse at all these meetings.
Right.
I don't necessarily know that that's, I mean, I think it's, we've already seen that they're unified and they're on the same page. I don't necessarily know that you need to have this many people directly involved because, I mean Ron Hainsey going at it with Gary Bettman, I mean, come on. I mean, let's get a deal done here. Let's stop this bickering. And to be honest with you, it seems like there still is some of that.
And that's not going to cause confusion. And that's not going to improve. It's not going to improve the bickering. As more money gets lost and more money, you know, is involved in sort of flying out the window, relationships here aren't going to get any better. But let's leave it there.
Having Ron Ainsley in the room, sorry, Drew, but having Ron Ainsley in the room is like having like the minority owner of the Predators in the room.
It's true. I mean, you're absolutely right. I mean, with all due respect to Ron Hainsey,
his rights still matter, but not as much as Crosby's, really, in the big scheme of things.
Right. Having Crosby there on a day-to-day basis carries a lot more weight.
That's right, his opinion.
Yeah. It carries a lot more weight having Crosby there than it does Ron Hainsey, and that's with all due respect.
That's all due respect.
Let's go to break. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. 1 hour down, 2 hours to go on TSN 1290. 1 hour down, 2 hours to go. Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Coming up in about 30 minutes' time, Michael McCann, he's the director of the Sports Law Institute at Vermont Law School. He's also a legal analyst and writer for Sports Illustrated. He's going to join us to talk about decertification and what it all really means, because that, like I said, that's the buzzword of the day. And, you know, we'll get into decertification coming up sort of, you know, half an hour time from now. But that's really the, you know...
And I agree with Paul Kelly when he... And we'll talk about it, as you mentioned, but I do agree with Paul Kelly when he says... it's a little bit too late for that probably at this point.
Well, I mean, what Donald Fear would say in, to counter that as well, the NBA threatened to decertify or started the process and they had a deal, you know, 6 days later.
I mean...
That's great. These sides seem so...
Is that why, or is it because of the money and the 60-game schedule?
Well, that's
opening on Christmas Day and LeBron and all that.
Chicken and egg argument,
that's
absolutely.
Right, that's right.
You'll never know the answer. I tend to think that if they go that route, we could be here for more than a year necessarily.
I just think that, and we'll ask Michael because he's an expert on that, but I just think that when it comes down to it, the end of the day, the possibility of a windfall, meaning triple damages, so meaning if there's damages by the players saying that they've been... they've lost billions of dollars, and then the court would order triple damages, so triple that amount.
Because that's what happens when you file an antitrust lawsuit.
And then you're victorious, if you are victorious. Now, this is the thing, Drew. In my opinion, hockey players would rather play for $10 million than wait 3 years for 30.
Which they may not even get. I mean, you've got to remember.
Exactly. Yeah. It's no guarantee. No court system's a guarantee. Yeah. But my point is... I mean, I just don't think it's in the players' blood to wait that long. I mean, what are they going to do?
Right. The USFL are the ones who won an antitrust lawsuit against the NFL back in late 70s, early 80s.
Yeah, I think that's about that.
And the USFL, for all their years of negotiations, you know how much they won?
How much?
$3.67. A dollar. They were awarded $1 in a judgment.
And then tripled.
Tripled, plus interest. So, you know, NHL... Congratulations! You might win $3. You might win, but you might lose the war if they decide to go down that road, and still a long way.
Yeah.
Pardon me, PA, and still a long way before that. Let's back to some more of the NHLPA's offer to the NHL. We sort of left off with the NHLPA proposing that the salary cap never fall lower than $67.25 million. You know, so that the cap would never be lower than that.
And it's class. It's you know, sacking and blowing. You can't say you're a partner and you're gonna be tied to revenues and then say tied to revenues. But I want to. It's like the owner's saying, let's tie to revenues. But if it gets to 70 mil, we're gonna cut it off there.
And that's exactly what they're trying to do. We're partners and we want to grow the business, but we also want to protect ourselves while leaving you with all the liability.
And it's especially ridiculous, Drew, in my opinion, when you see where the damage has already been done. There's no guarantee everybody comes back. There are fans who will never come back. there are markets that may not recover. We don't know. And there's a lot of uncertainty. So if you're going to be moving forward as partners, move forward as partners. And don't move forward as partners with
let me ask
guarantees.
You guys this question. And this is something that that's interested me for a while now in this lockout.
Okay.
Why wouldn't the NHL want to remove the salary cap from being tied to revenues?
Of course they would. At this point, they're not going to get that.
Well, but this is pretty much what it is. If the NHL,
this is being tied to revenues if they make money and not tied if they lose money.
Well, but if you think back to the previous offers from the NHLPA, those numbers weren't necessarily tied to revenues very much. They were establishing this is what it's going to be this year, this is what it's going to be next year.
Right, but there were strong projections at 7.65% minimum.
Right.
So who knows if the NHL grows at that level. That's peak levels. So it's essentially saying, well, if the NHL continues to grow at peak levels, we're going to make this much money. If it doesn't, well, we're going to make that much money anyhow. So, sure, it's not necessarily tied to revenue, so to speak, but you're projecting it at a level that you can't really lose any money. So it is, but it isn't, to put it that way. In all honesty, it is, because the projections aren't necessarily completely accurate, but they're strongly in your favor. So what's the detriment? There really isn't a detriment.
I think Drew's posing a good question, though. I mean, if you look at it, this whole issue is that salaries have gone up too much. The salary cap's gotten too high proportionate to revenues. I think everybody will agree with that's the core economic issue, and now they're trying to lower it down a little bit. I don't think what enough people are talking about is that and you know, that's why I think it's really frustrating to hear all of these players and say, you know, they want to take, you know, roll back our salaries again, is that the revenues are going to go up. I think we'll all agree with the Canadian television contract and the fact that, you know, ticket prices aren't going down 2% every year.
That's right.
For Winnipeg Jets season ticket holders, their tickets are going up every year. Yeah. Tickets go up every year. Television revenue
they
goes
have
up
option,
every year.
But they always
yeah,
can.
So revenue is going to go up every year. So, yes, the NHLPA is being asked, as part of this, the NHL CBA offer, obviously, and they're agreeing it to it, that the percentage of the contracts are going to be 50% in relation to revenue, Drew. But getting back to your point, the reason why it's good is you could say for the NHL owners, they would love to know that every year the salary cap's going to be
their costs are fixed.
Costs are fixed. They would love to know their costs are fixed. $62 million this year, $64 million next year. Or maybe they just say that each year, $70 million is the salary cap. To be honest with you, and again, we would probably encounter a lot of arguments from possibly player agents and players. NHL players make a lot of money. The $2.5 million average salary is a lot of money. I mean, how much is enough money? I mean, if each year it's $70 million, maybe you look at it and you say during the next CBA, then we look at maybe raising it. But when your average salary is $2.5 million in a $3 billion industry, that's pretty good. And I think that not only when owners like that, fans would like to know that too, knowing that their ticket prices aren't going to go up. If you have a hard salary cap, Drew, you'd probably know that your ticket prices aren't going to go up.
But you're assuming the owners are going to be in good faith, not raise ticket prices, which I don't believe in for a second.
I don't think anybody's going to be. You'd be naive to believe anybody's going to be doing anything in good faith at this point in time.
Yeah, and the fans take the brunt of it. I have no reason to believe that the fans are going to be the benefactors of anything that occurs here.
We talk about, I mean, this is getting a little bit off topic here, but, yeah. You know, you talk about what's happened since the last lockout. You know, if you were to look at salaries and the percentage points that they've gone up,
uh-huh.
Ticket prices have probably gone up, you know, on the same line. I mean, ticket prices have gone up and up and up. You can't pay these guys unless you're charging these ticket prices. And again, does anybody ever talk about that? I mean, honestly, I mean, if fans weren't paying, you know, $200 a game, you know, for a high ticket in Toronto, you're paying $20,000. I mean, you couldn't pay these guys, you know, $5, $7 million a year if ticket prices weren't that high.
Skate-driven league, 100%.
Exactly right. That was pretty much the majority of the financial issues in the NHLPA's offer. They did have certain contracting issues. Obviously, the NHL is really going hard after contracts.
The back-loaded
contracts. Back-diving and everything else. And the reason why the NHL is going after that isn't really because it's to their benefit so much as it is because they know that their general managers can't help themselves.
That's right. Now, one of the things people don't realize necessarily is that the NHL is also trying to go after contracts signed under the previous CBA for long-term deals, penalize them already. Right. So basically go back and penalize them, which generally speaking isn't common practice. You go on a go-forward basis. I mean, you don't put laws into effect and then penalize people based on the new law.
Who you can't retroactively punish somebody for something that wasn't a crime back then.
That's exactly right.
The NHLPA is obviously not signing up for most of the NHL's contracting offers. The one that they have agreed to is to eliminate the backdiving contracts like Ilya Kovalchuk's and Roberto Luongo's that have big money up front and then drop to...
Only a nine-year deals.
Only, yes. That they've agreed to that as long as the deal is a minimum of 9 years.
Yeah.
Frankly, if you're signing any NHL hockey player to a 9-year deal or longer, you're probably a bad general manager.
Well, and you know, as you know, Drew, when we talked about this, when Ilya Kovalchuk signed the deal, the only reason he got the extra few years was so that they could pay him more in the beginning. They might not have signed him to that many years, but you know, because they're paying him $8, $9, $10 million, whatever it is, they have to, you know, flatten it out so that the last few years he's getting $1 million.
Even Detroit, you know, a smart general manager, Drew, not every, you know, the contract that is that long is stupid necessarily, but I mean, even Detroit, you know, you have Zetterberg, you have France, and you have all those guys. I mean, Detroit's getting to be a little bit of an old team here, and they have some young prospects that are good players, don't get me wrong. But their core is a little older, and they haven't for a significant period of time. I just think the long-term deals, and they were trying to take advantage of the loophole. But even then, you know, look at Ovechkin. He's not the same player he was 3 years ago. Maybe he comes back. He certainly has the capability of doing so. But if not, I mean, you locked him up for that period of time, and
you have another decade or whatever it is of Ovechkin at this level.
Yeah, hurt your flexibility. I hate long-term deals.
At the same point in time, you also hate every deal having to look exactly the same do in the NBA.
I don't like that, yeah. So I don't mind the nine-year thing. I don't really mind that. I'm fine with it. I don't mind the ability for these guys to sign long-term deals. I just don't like that they sign nine-year deals. Because then, as I've said this before, when you have the 5-6 year cap, every NBA contract, is the same. This for this. So you have no incentive. If you're a team, if you're Winnipeg, and you think that, you know, I think this guy's worth more to me, I want to pay him more than New York can pay him because to me, this guy means more to the market. So I pay him 8 years, 64, not 8 years maxed out at 42 because everybody's offering the same contract. I mean, where's the incentive? Now, in that case, you have to probably incentivize, you know, teams with the rights. Larry Bird rights, so to speak, in basketball to have a benefit. But that's a whole
Larry
different
Bird rights being that you get an exception to sign your own players, you keep your own free agent, you can offer them more than any other team can.
Yeah.
If you're going to sign a guy,
you'll be able to go over the cap,
you know,
too.
Yes, go over the cap
and
do that.
Sign a guy to 10 years, give him the same. If you really want a player that bad and he's, I mean, you know, coming to the league, if it's a Nathan MacKinnon, I mean, we just saw Sidney Crosby signed a 10-year deal. Sign him 10 years, give him $7 million a year. Don't give him $14 million in the first year and then $2 million in the last few years of the deal, because that was clear that was salary cap circumvention, and that's why it appears that the NHL and the NHLPA are both on the... It's funny that they're actually on the same page on anything. But
they're not yet, because the NHL is so insistent, and they're so dug in, and I'm surprised how dug in they are on these contracting issues. Now, obviously, I don't know this, but I have to see if anything's going to break. That seems like it's a relatively easy break to come to agreement with. If the NHL is going to give something up, though it's not really giving anything up because it's just continuing the status quo
I think what it is, Drew, is, you know, you say, hey, well, you know, if you move down to $90 million make whole, you know, in the middle right now, 182, for a total of whatever, $300 million, if you move down to that make whole, we'll make some movement on the contracting issues. That's what I think it's there for.
Yeah. And you know, you're right though, on the entry level contracts, the way I look at it, I don't know how the NHLPA is going to accept moving down to 2 years or the unrestricted free agency age, because again, they've made all the concessions. Well, I mean, I hate to use that word, but they've agreed to go down to 50%, whatever that's going to finally end up being. But I don't see how they're going to want the higher unrestricted free agency age.
I agree with you. Let's go to break. When we come back, some more from the Illegal Curve Hockey Show here on TSN 1290. Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve. Follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/Illegal Curve. This segment of the program is brought to you by the Certified General Accountants Association of Manitoba. The CGA Association of Manitoba is the largest, fastest growing, and most diverse accounting body in the province. Did you know that CGAs are among the top 5% of income earners in Canada? with an average yearly salary of $72,000 for new graduates. For more information, contact the CGA Association of Manitoba at cga-manitoba.org or give them a call at 204-477-1256. The CGA Association of Manitoba, we see more than numbers. Speaking of the CGA Association, our good friend over there, Zach Manouk, wedding weekend this weekend.
Really?
That's right. So congratulations to Zach and his
Is Richie related
bride?
To him, though? Because you're related?
Yes, of course.
I wanted to ask you a question. You know, you read that so well. Obviously, CGA is a new sponsor of ours. Did you know that I'm a decertified general accountant?
I knew you were going to say
and
that.
And I make $2,000 a year.
I knew you were going to say that. I
saw that coming from a mile away.
I saw that in your face.
You were very excited about that. Yeah, you know.
Again, I should be at Rumors basically on a daily basis.
We'll do the Rumors promo next segment. How about that?
Yeah.
Just a quick update. As we've, you know, anybody that follows us on Twitter or anywhere has been well aware, we've been very involved with Movember. And Ezzy and I are both sporting some terrible facial hair to commemorate the event.
I wouldn't call it terrible, Drew. You're actually getting, yours is getting, you know, better. It's getting darker. It's getting thicker. Have you trimmed?
I haven't. Richie, would you describe our facial hair as terrible?
Yeah, it's brutal, like both of you.
Yeah.
Before the show, Richie was telling me that it looked good.
I was at synagogue this morning, and the rabbi made a comment about the facial hair. He's like, I hope you're doing Movember, because that's awful.
Yeah, it's pretty bad.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Oh, we have the rabbi on.
the rabbi's on the line. I saw Jay Onwrights this morning. I hadn't seen him in a while.
He's winning. He has the best.
He's won.
He won.
That's just dirty.
I don't know how you can grow that.
Because Ezzy's got facial hair with the mustache.
I'm doing the handlebars.
Yeah,
but what Jay Onwright's doing is he's almost bringing in like the ends of the sideburns into the handlebars.
That's right, yeah.
He's really perfected it. His mustache is a work of art.
The reason why I brought up Movember is just to say thank you to everybody who has supported us and Team Illegal Curve. We're now just under $4,200 raised for Movember.
Awesome. So our goal is $5,000.
Okay, so we have another little bit of a push to make.
Days. Dave Manouk is, even though you're the captain, Dave Manouk should really be the captain because he got Zach Bogosian and Mark Stewart.
You'd say that.
You know, we've got some Jets on there, but it's been great.
Yeah, but I don't think a Stewart made race. I checked that the other day. Bogosian's raised no money.
Yeah.
I
kicked it off.
Mark Stewart's leading the team right now. He's up about $1,200. Yeah. I'm in second place. You know, pat on my back, of course. And actually, Dave and Ezzy are fighting it out for third place. Dave is now taking a bit of a lead on you, Ezzy. You might need to step it up.
I mean,
Dave sends a lot of emails though, like asking
Dave panders. Whoever is getting the donations, whether it's Dave, yourself, Bogo, Stewart. You know, donate to our team if you're listening out there because it's a good cause. It's for prostate cancer research and awareness as well as mental health, mental health. So it's a good cause. Donate to any of us. You know,
donate to the team as a whole.
I mean, and I think it's safe to say we're going to be doing this every year now. We had Jeff Paulson and Jennifer Botterill on, and, you know, it's such a good cause. We're going to be involved with this every year. I mean, I actually, like, really enjoy raising money. Like, I enjoy it, and the only bad part is that I have a dirty mustache.
Well, as you actually went to the Fusion Corner a couple weeks ago, the fundraiser for it, and as you had Mo Ribs.
Mo Ribs. Nice. And you can find it. Go to ca.movember.com, search for Illegal Curve Hockey, and you can find our team and see all the facial hair that has been created for Movember. Let's talk about this Roman Haverlick and Michael Neuwirth versus Eric Cole and Troy Brouwer conversation. We spoke about it briefly before. You know, Haverlick pretty much, you know, understands the story and understands his situation in the game at this point in time. You know, he says, look, this is my last contract. Every dollar that I'm not earning that I should be earning this year, I'm never going to make back. He knows that his career is pretty much up at this point in time. Michael Neuwirth, only 24, so you wouldn't necessarily think that he'd be, you know, in lockstep with Haverlick.
Winnipeg fans would know him from the Calder Cup.
Right, exactly. Yep. He was the goaltender for the Hershey Bears that year. Michael Neuwirth, you know, says, I agree 100% with Hammer, speaking of Roman Haverlick. This lockout is not about the majority of players, I think. It is about several superstars with big contracts.
Well, that's he's alluding to the make whole,
right?
Because the big money in terms of getting that money, you know, remember the people who don't have contracts right now, the players who don't have contracts, which I think is about 20%. Is how they say the number? It seems high, but in any event, what do they care about make whole? There's nothing to make whole.
That's right. If you're not getting any money and you have no money coming to you, then exactly why do you care about make whole?
Right.
So they made their comments perfectly within their rights to do so, and then coming back at them was Eric Cole and yesterday Troy Brower. Let me just pull up Eric Cole.
And Troy Brower is Washington's player rep.
Troy Brower, so I mean, it's going to make for an interesting dynamic in the Capitals dressing room if that situation ever comes about. You know, you're going to have Troy Brower, you're going to have Neuwirth, and you're going to have Hamrlik all on the same team. Here's Eric Cole on Roman Hamrlik. For him to come out and say this, it's the most selfish thing I've heard during the lockout, without a doubt, Eric Cole said. It's just disappointing. You'd think the veteran guys are the guys who would take more pride in what other veteran guys sacrificed in the last lockout, how we all benefited from that as a group. Some guys never played again.
Did they benefit from that?
I don't think so.
Well, their salaries went up, but they lost a year of salaries.
And the guys who never played again, do they? I mean, you think those guys aren't regretting their decisions?
No. And, you know, I have something to say about this because, you know, Andrew, you mentioned earlier that you thought, you know, Roman Hamrlik was right. And I have to commend Roman Hamrlik, first of all, for not only saying that, because, I actually think that he is partially right. But he went on TSN after he said it.
Yes, I agree.
And he defended himself and didn't back down. And I respect that because, you know, quite frankly, a lot of guys have been saying things knowing that their owners could be reading this or, you know, they might have, you know, said something a little bit out of line. And then they start to say, okay, I apologize. But, you know, Roman Hamrlik.
Jeff O'Neill's. Did you see Jeff O'Neill the other day? I mean, we'll get to the Twitter things later on. Jeff O'Neill, you know, says his inflammatory comment about making hole in Gary Bettman's head or something along those lines.
Yeah,
I apologize. I've been hacked. Sure you have, Jeff.
Yeah, I love that.
Sure, you've been hacked.
That's cowardly.
Pretty sure, yeah.
Hamrlik's entitled to his opinion. Is there a selfish tone to what he's saying? Yes, there absolutely is. If I'm a player, a member of the players' union, I've been actively involved. Am I angry? Maybe, but when you're a member, there's 700 players. Yeah. There's going to be some divergent views.
Yep. To pretend otherwise.
Just deal with it. I mean, don't call it every guy who doesn't say something that's in lockstep with what you believe.
One of the funniest things, though, sorry, Drew, that Hamrlik said, if you listen to his interview with TSN, because the other one was in a Czech newspaper, he said, oh, I guess Eric Cole doesn't mind as much because of that signing bonus he got with Montreal.
And he said credit to Eric Cole for it. Yeah. You know, the signing bonus is there. It's his money. You know, and also, just because a guy comes out and says something against the PA doesn't necessarily mean the entire PA is about to crumble before our very eyes.
Also true.
No.
Roman Hamrlik's entitled to his opinion. I happen to think that in Roman Hamrlik's case, he's 100% correct, and a guy like Scott Gomez or a guy like anybody that's at the tail end of their career who are never going to get this big money again should all probably believe the same thing.
Right, and that's
whether
the point.
Whether or not they publicly say it or not is their decision.
That's the point, Drew. Hamrlik, Timo Salani has said he might not come back if he doesn't play this year. So it's those guys. Mm-hmm. I've always used like the Sean O'Donnell, the guy, the sixth, seventh defenseman that's making $1 million below, you know, the league average. Those are the guys that are obviously, they have to be selfish. But in the grand scheme of things, this isn't going to affect the negotiations at all. These guys are just frustrated. Why wouldn't you be? You're Roman Hamrlik. I mean, you're sitting there, you're part of the NHLPA. This is your third work stoppage. You know, you've lost so much money. What is he supposed to say? Oh, yeah.
I'm okay with this. I don't need my millions of dollars.
Yeah, so, you know, I mean, it's... For anybody to say that this is about the future, sure, it's about the future of your own contracts. These guys are all being selfish in a way.
As they should be. I don't criticize them for it. As they should be. Now, the question is, you know, is the make-whole really about Sidney Crosby and Alex Ovechkin and their $11 million? And should they necessarily be, are they being selfish by demanding it? Well, that's something for the PA to decide on their own. But if they are being selfish, I certainly don't begrudge them necessarily.
But I don't understand how it's more about it when the CBA affects everyone. Like, I mean, yeah, of course, those guys make more money.
Because it's relative to the amount of money. You know.
But if the majority of players, let's say, make between $2 and $4 million, and those were the guys that really were sick of this lockout and just wanted it, I think the lockout would be over at this point. I don't think that the rich players... The rich players don't outnumber the players that make, let's say, $5 million and above are in a smaller percentage.
How actively involved, though, when we asked Paul Kelly about this, how actively involved are majority of the players. He said about half the players are overseas. How actively involved are those guys? They're playing games all the time. They're practicing. They wake me up when it's over.
Exactly. Yeah.
Agreed. Let's go to break. When we come back, Michael McCann, the director of the Sports Law Institute at the Vermont Law School. He's also a legal analyst and writer for Sports Illustrated, will talk to us about decertification. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show live on TSN 1290.